Thanks, Adrian, and thank you, David, for your kind words in the introduction. So just to emphasise, the report that Adrian and I prepared made recommendations about what we should do in the event that the UK chooses not to associate with Horizon Europe. We made no assessment about whether we should associate. That is a different analysis for a different report. Our exam question was confined to what happens in the event that we do not associate. And we took the view that the decision on association would be made at a senior political level in a much wider political context. It is not one that will be made by the science community alone. And we assume that the decision will factor in the much wider political and economic consequences of a decision not to associate. And in that event, we found no convincing argument for beginning a period outside the European programmes with a line-by-line replication of what was going on in Europe. You don't take such a big decision and then make the world look as if the decision wasn't made. So we need to get that out on the table, because that is not, we did not start from a position of making it look as if the decision wasn't taken. So where did we start from? Well, actually, we started by saying that the first priority would be to protect and stabilise the capabilities that have been acquired by this country over several decades of participation in EU programmes. And any temptation to get into whizzy new schemes in international collaboration should be postponed until resources have been set aside to protect and stabilise capability. And so that led us to put together this graphic. I think we've got some people from NPL here, so they'll be able to tell us the SI units for boldness. But you get the drift. And so we set out quite explicitly, it was our first recommendation, and it was the recommendation that we said explicitly should have the highest priority of all in the short term. With that in place, but only with that in place, we then went on to set out a framework for global collaboration. And I'll take you through a few highlights of that, but our report has been in the public domain for a few months, should you want to go into more detail. We operated under three headlines. First of all, we saw this as an opportunity to make really quite aggressive moves on the 2.4% agenda, particularly opportunities to attract higher levels of business investment in R&D to the UK from all around the world. And we have set out specific funding interventions with a view to attracting higher levels, particularly of business investment. We also think that this great time of change, time of turmoil even, is an opportunity for a more aggressive move on these persistent and frustrating disparities between different parts of the UK, which so many governments have tried to address, and they've never quite managed to break down the great differences that we find between parts of this really quite small island. The other observation that we made was that if we look at the amount of money going into international collaboration and compare it with the amount of activity that is visible in international collaboration, there's a mismatch. You see far more research being done internationally than you can account for by funding streams that are specifically for the purpose of international collaboration. Because actually, research is done internationally. It's just what researchers do. But for years, and actually, I think Adrian and I both had vivid memories of serving David Willetts, and David finding it frustrating that there was never money available to pick up a good opportunity that was identified at political level or at scientific level. And so we have recommended that there should be funding set aside for the express purpose of increasing the agility of the research base and allowing researchers and politicians both to grab fast-moving opportunities that are frankly not going to hang around for 12 months while funding protocols are observed and grant applications are processed. And that bit of the research funding system has been sadly absent for much of my career. And David, I hope you take some comfort from the thought that your wisdom persisted. We also made a recommendation in the field of immigration policy, which actually is not terribly far away from the global talent visa that Priti Patel announced last week. We felt that for far too long this country had half an immigration policy. It has a policy for regulating entry to the country, but the other half of the policy about attracting talent to the country was absent. And so we recommended a much closer alignment between immigration policy on the one hand and research and innovation policy on the other. And I think that last week's announcement goes a very considerable way to meeting the things that we set out in the report. Now, we encountered huge enthusiasm for the European Research Council. It's an elegant design of a funding mechanism. It's immensely popular in some parts of the community. It's also something that would be difficult to continue to access unless there was full association with Horizon Europe, and full association might prove challenging. So we recommended what we have called a flagship program of research fellowships, which frankly we arrived at by unpicking the European Research Council machinery, looking at the bits that people liked best and making each one of them a bit better. That was all we did. The European Research Council is held in enormously high esteem, but it is only sort of 15 years old or thereabouts, and we were not convinced that it was beyond replication, given money, political will, and patience. Now, Adrian and I are both sort of long enough in the tooth to understand the complexities of designing new funding systems. So we backed off from a highly specified funding machinery, but what we did do was to set out a number of principles and then go on to derive a number of options. And in essence, we think that that if we are going to treat international collaboration seriously in a post-Brexit world, then there will need to be dedicated administrative machinery that develops a high level of expertise in the craft of international collaboration, working with immigration authorities, developing deals with funding agencies overseas, and so on. Finally, I think there are a number of bits of unfinished business, and I offer these as my closing remarks. First of all, what is the process by which the government is going to decide on our future participation in European programmes? What level of engagement will there be from the research community? Will the evidence behind the decision be made transparent? I don't yet have a clear picture of how that bit's going to work. The Treasury provided a very welcome funding guarantee in the event that the UK left the EU without a deal. The UK has left the EU with a deal, and the Treasury guarantee has therefore lapsed, according to its own terms, the terms in which it was offered. So where would money for a protect and stabilise agenda come from? I talked about agility funding. I was deliberately talking about money that's really quite a long way away from the protocols of awarding research grants. So how would that money be governed? There would be public accountability for it, but it would need a quite different governance model to the thing we're used to, because it would be a quite different funding model. And finally, you'll recall that Adrian pointed to disciplines like archaeology and the classics and regions of the UK that have an unusually high dependence on EU funding. What's the government and what's UKRI going to do about them? Do we care that there are domains within the research and innovation community that stand to lose not 3% of their research funding, but something more like 30%? Is there a process of consideration for deciding whether or not they should be given transition support or just allowed to find their place in the new world? I'll stop there. Thank you very much for your attention.